By this time last year, many lawns around the state were dormant. This year, conditions have been perfect for growing lush green grass and weeds. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. I'll talk with Nick Christians, a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. He is also a turf grass specialist. This hour, we'll talk about summer lawn care and his work using corn gluten meal as an organic herbicide. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here, and he and Nick will answer your questions about the plants in your life. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here in a few minutes to answer your questions. You can get in line with your questions right now by sending us an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post on our Facebook page or tweet us at IPR Talk. But first, we're going to focus on summer lawn care this hour. Nick Christians is here. He's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and a turf grass specialist. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you, Charity?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And let's talk about how lawns are faring this year, because as I mentioned earlier on the billboard, by this time last year, a lot of lawns were actually dormant, and there was quite a bit of damage last year from the drought. How are lawns recovering this year with conditions?
They're recovering surprisingly well. Last year was one of the hardest years I can remember, and I've been here for 34 years now, so that's a lot of years, but that was a tough one. We did get a lot of thinning. We got a lot of damage, but the moisture this year has brought them back pretty quick.
And we've had a lot of moisture this year. Has that created any new issues for lawns?
Not really. We came close to the point where they were too wet, and it kind of depends on where you're at. In some areas, they had more rain than others. Here in central Iowa, it was wet, but it didn't do any damage to them. They grew too well. You had to mow every 4 days to keep up with it. But other than that, they recovered well, and they're looking pretty good. Getting a little dry now, but they recovered well in the spring.
Right. Well, and with the needing to mow every 4 days, we had a hard time with that in the Iowa City area because it kept raining all the time. So it was almost impossible to get out there and mow. For those of us who didn't do that and our lawns went to seed, has that created any problems?
No, that doesn't hurt anything. I had the same problem here. I was either gone or it was raining. It kind of turns your lawn into a hay field, and you've got a lot of clippings on top. But that's kind of gone now, and they're looking much better.
All right. So this time of year, in July, what are some of the things we should be thinking about with our lawns?
There's a couple of things. Right now, there's a lot of crabgrass showing up. With lawns, timing is everything. If you miss the right time to do something, it can come back to catch you later. And if people didn't get a pre-emergence herbicide down of some kind this spring, they probably got a lot of crabgrass peeking through now. That germinates about May 1, and this is about the time of year you start seeing it. Light green grass coming up through your lawn.
And if you have a lot of crabgrass, is there anything you can do about it at this point?
There is a chemical for that. It's called quinclorac, Drive is the commercial name for it. I was in Lowe's yesterday looking to see what was available, and they did have it for homeowners now. You can get it and spot treat out, and that will selectively kill the crabgrass and not kill the bluegrass or the ryegrass.
Do you recommend that, or do you just recommend waiting until next year and hoping to hit the sweet spot?
That's a personal decision. Crabgrass can get so bad in a wet year that it just kind of takes over a lawn. It looks terrible. A lot of people who know what it is want to do something to control it. So do I recommend quinclorac? If you use chemicals and it's probably expensive, I would say yes. Otherwise, you just wait it out. The crabgrass will continue to mature. It'll produce a big seed crop in late August, and then it'll all die and come back from seed next year.
Is there anything you should be doing for the crabgrass in the fall?
Not in the fall. It's spring is the key time, and the key date in central Iowa, at least, is May 1. That's going to be a little earlier in southern Iowa, a little later in northern Iowa. But you need to get a pre-emergence herbicide, one that will control the germinating seed without hurting your perennial grasses like Kentucky bluegrass. That has to go down before germination. If you miss germination, then at this time of year, you're going to see a lot of crabgrass.
Now, there has been a lot more interest in organic control in lawns, in gardens, really all over the place over the last couple of decades. And you were part of a project that found that you could use corn gluten meal as a natural pre-emergence herbicide. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, this actually goes back a long ways. That began in 1986. The first observations on this, we were doing a trial completely unrelated to weed control or anything like that. We were using using cornmeal and noticed an inhibition of germination of certain species. Later on, I did some other work and found that it was the protein fraction of the corn, which is called corn gluten meal. And by the way, that's not corn gluten feed. That's something different, corn gluten meal. 60% protein. And found that that would inhibit the germination of a number of plants and that we could use it as a pre-emergence herbicide, natural pre-emerge in the spring, and it's also a good fertilizer source. So it's a nice combination.
How do you apply it?
In a granular form. You can buy it. It comes from the production facilities as a powder, but they pelletize it so you can spread it through a fertilizer spreader. And if you got the right stuff, it spreads pretty easy.
Now, the patent was taken out on that in 1991. Has it caught on? Is it
something
that a lot of people are using?
It caught on very well. The patent is now ended. It ended about 2 years ago. But here at Iowa State, we had a patent on that for 17 years. A lot of product was sold. We had, I think, at one time 23 different companies marketing it. Probably the big sales were on the East Coast and the West Coast. That is where it caught on a lot. Canada, we've had a lot of sales up there, although we didn't have a Canadian patent on it. But the patent is now off. It's still available, but the patent's off.
And have you been looking around at other possible things like that? I mean, it sounds like you sort of stumbled on that on accident.
Yep. For years and years, that was an accident. And for all the years in between, I've been looking for other stuff. I do have a patent pending right now on something that's not available yet. But I found it's awfully hard to do it when you're looking for it. You almost got to get lucky.
Well, what were you doing with it when you figured out that it would work that way?
We originally worked it into a sand-based golf course green out at the research station. We use cornmeal, not corn gluten meal. Cornmeal as a media to grow a fungal organism on. And as a part of that study, we grew the fungal organism on the cornmeal and then put out a control, which was just raw cornmeal out of the bag. And it was the raw cornmeal out of the bag that inhibited the germination. So that was the first observation on it.
Oh, very interesting. So have you noticed that there's been a big increase in interest for organic control in lawn care?
I would say right now we're probably on the downslope of that. There was a really big interest in the 90s. It's remained strong, but what you find, and you'll find that with the corn gluten meal, it's more expensive and it doesn't work as well as the chemical. So you've got to be dedicated to this. You've got to be willing to put a lot of money into it and do this diligently, and then it's probably not going to give you the same control as the chemically based materials. So the demand for natural organics is still there, but I've seen it peak out, and then I've seen it kind of go the other way.
Interesting. I'm talking with Nick Christians. He's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. He's also a turf grass specialist. Richard Duran from Iowa State University Extension Horticulture will join us in just a moment. They are both here today to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. That number again is 866-780-9100. And before we get to the break, Nick, let's go over a few nuts and bolts. Right now, of course, you mentioned lawns are starting to dry out a little bit. Do you recommend watering?
If you can water, I recommend watering. Yes, it's going to be better for the lawn. That's kind of a local decision. In some areas, water is very expensive. I live about 10 miles outside of Ames. I have rural water. I've got about an acre of lawn, and for me to water would be economically prohibitive. And that's the case with a lot of people. But certainly watering is a good thing if you can afford it and you're in an area where you can do it.
And you mentioned when it was really wet this spring, we were needing to mow about every 4 days, which, trust me, did not happen at my house. Right now, with conditions the way they are, how often do you recommend mowing, and when do you decide? How long does the grass get before you think I need to mow that?
You should let it get up to where you need to mow back about one-third of it is the rule of thumb. So if you're mowing at 2 inches, you should let it get up to 3. You don't want to let it get too high, as most of us did when it was raining hard. The grasses that we're working with here, like bluegrass and ryegrass, are cool season grasses. They thrive in cooler conditions. About 72 degrees is what they like the best. And whether you've got water or not, they'll slow down a lot in midsummer because of the heat. So we find in the spring, if you get plenty of water, you're mowing every 4 days. That might go down in the heat of midsummer, even if you're watering a lot, to maybe 8 to 10 days.
And you mentioned mowing down to 2 inches. How low do you mow?
I keep mine up a little higher, 3 to 3.5. The higher the better, the more competitive the grass is going to be with weeds. So that's kind of a personal decision. Some people like it. You don't want to mow lower than 2 inches on bluegrass. Some people will do that. Then you're inviting the crabgrass and other weeds in. But 2 to 3.5 inches is usually a standard.
All right. And we are just about to get to a break, but let's try to sneak in one lawn care question before we get there. Rudy is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Rudy.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have this problem on my lawn. It's Creeping Charlie. My neighbor has it all over his backyard, and it's creeping into my property now, and I want to know how do I control it. I was out yesterday, and I was kind of raking it or holding it up and it just comes out like in vine type, you know. What can I put on it now to control that before it spreads any further?
Chemically, I would stay away from it now at this time of year. The chemicals that are somewhat effective on that, and nothing is really completely effective, but the ones that are somewhat effective are also quite effective on broadleaf trees and shrubs and flowers and tomatoes and everything else. And at this time of year, they tend to volatilize and they'll hurt your other landscape plants. So I would let it go at this time. Doing what you're doing, trying to rake it up, will help.
All right, and when should he put some control on it?
Late in the fall is possible. I've had the best luck in even November with post-emergence broadleaf controls like 2,4-D.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to answer your horticulture questions with me, Nick Christians, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. You can call us, 866-780-9100 is the number. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me is Nick Christians. He's a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. And also joining us now is horticulturist Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here today. And of course, you can join our conversation as well with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll start with this email from Cynthia in Fort Dodge. She says, we have 20 very old and large oak trees, probably 100 years old, in our yard. I don't know what type of oak they are. They have some dead in them every year, but this year there's more, and one in particular is getting dead brown leaves mostly at the top. It looks like the tree is dying. The other trees seem to have some dead leaves, but just a few. I've heard that with the drought last year and more rain this year, this could be the cause, as it put stress on them. Someone told us to put annual tree and shrub insect control on them, which is a liquid that you dissolve in water. Another person told us not to do anything, but that it would work itself out. I've also heard that if one tree gets something that is making it die, it could go to the other trees and cause a problem. What are your thoughts?
My first thought is, if these are that old, last year's drought shouldn't have been that harmful, I don't think. They should have been able to tolerate that. So I don't think that's a big factor. I would be concerned about any type of root disturbance. Make sure that you don't have anything that would disturb the roots, like construction activity, changing the grade, anything of that type, because oak trees do not like to be disturbed. So any type of root damage could cause dieback. Disease-wise, I'm concerned about oak wilt and possibly bur oak blight. Those are two that I would be concerned about. If they have branches that are low enough, maybe they don't, but if they do, it would be a good idea to go out and prune off maybe three or four branches, maybe a foot, foot and a half in length, about pencil size and thickness. And you want to choose branches that are clearly showing the symptoms and then put them in a plastic bag, keep them cool, and then bring those down to the county extension office and request they send that to the Plant and Insect Diagnostic Clinic here at Iowa State, where the staff can look at those and see if they can see something that might explain what's going on. Those would be the biggest concern that I have for oaks. Any type of root disturbance, oak wilt, and bur oak blight would be the main things.
All right. And she needs to figure out what it is before she can figure out what to do about it, right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, let's go to the phones now. Dave is on the line from Johnston. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question?
So I've got a lawn that has bluegrass, Kentucky bluegrass, and I put down an application of Scott's Weed and Feed Plus 2, I think, about 6 weeks ago. And that did a pretty good job, and it took a few weeks for it to take effect. It did a pretty good job of, you know, knocking back the weeds from being taken over, I guess, too much. But they're starting to come back through, and I know as it gets warmer, the weeds are just going to continue to grow and grow. I guess my question is, can I put down, would it be appropriate to put down another application of that same Scotts Weed and Feed Plus 2 right now?
No, this is Nick. I would not recommend that you put that back down. At the beginning, I mentioned that timing is everything with lawns. You can do it almost effortlessly if your timing is right, and you can fight yourself all through the season if your timing is wrong. The best time for the broadleaf weeds is going to be the fall, and preferably later in the fall, September, October, even November if it's not snowing. I would wait and put the dandelion and plantain, those types of controls down at that time of year. People often forget that because they're not really thinking of the weeds then. But if you wait until you see them in the spring, that's a hard time to control them.
Okay, so is there anything I can do in the meantime to help, you know, control these weeds up until the fall when I put the second application down?
Now, it depends on what you're talking about species-wise. Are you talking about dandelion and that sort of thing, or crabgrass?
I have a, behind my yard, I've got a nice, there's a nice plot of land and a farmer, well, farms it. It's full of weeds. I couldn't tell you what's growing back there, but that stuff blows into my backyard and sort of, you know, comes up. The best way to describe it, they look like sort of like, they're light colored weeds, but they have, the leaves sort of point vertically, I guess is the best way to put it. They come up in patches all over the place.
It's a grassy type weed or more of a broadleaf?
It's more of a weed. It's like a, some sort of broadleaf weed.
Okay, yeah, that would take a different kind of chemical. It's not wrong at this time of year to put a chemical like that down, but you run the risk of it volatilizing and doing damage to other landscape plants. At this time, you could spot treat. You could mix up a small container, a sprayer, and go out and hit them individually with a material like 2,4-D or MCPP, something like that. But I wouldn't give it a general spray. I would put it on your calendar and in late September give it that general spray of broadleaves, and I think next year you'll be pretty happy with what you see.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for your call. And next up, let's go to Rick in Liberty, Missouri. Hi, Rick.
Hi. Yeah, I actually live in Missouri, but I spend so much time traveling in Iowa that I'm a member of Iowa Public Radio.
Oh, that's great to hear. Thanks, Rick. What's your question?
Well, quick question. I had a neighbor that I love dearly. She's a great person, but she liked the smell of Japanese honeysuckle and planted some in her yard. I did not know what that meant. until 2 or 3 years later, and now about a third of my yard has Japanese honeysuckle coming in from every angle and every form. What do I do to attack it?
Well, I think you have two means of control. One is to physically dig it up. It can be done. It can be rather tedious, but you can do that. I think the other option would be to use a herbicide like Roundup or glyphosate. Basically destroy it that way. So I think those are the two main options, would be to physically dig it up or apply something like Roundup or glyphosate.
Okay, and if I spray Roundup, do I have a concern about if the chemical going into the soil when it's close to my trees, like my tulip trees and things like that?
No, you don't. That's one of the nice things about glyphosate or Roundup, is that it's not absorbed by the root system. So you can use this around trees and shrubs. As long as you don't get it on the tree or shrub itself directly, you're not going to have a problem. Now, it will kill things like grass, okay? It's not okay. Selective. So whatever you apply the Roundup to directly, like on the foliage, will be destroyed. But
the root system
will not absorb it.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Rick, thanks a lot for your call. And is Rick going to get any traction if his neighbor still has Japanese honeysuckle?
Well, it's going to be kind of a vicious circle, I'm afraid, because the birds love the fruit. They eat the fruit, and then they distribute the seeds in various areas. So it's going to be a kind of a vicious circle, I think.
All right. And when you talk about spraying Roundup, is that a situation where you would recommend actually cutting them down and spraying it on the stump as opposed to trying to spray the whole thing?
It kind of depends upon the number. If the area is just covered with let's say, seedlings, that may not be that practical. But if it's just a few plants, then I would suggest maybe cutting them off and then applying the Roundup directly to the cut surfaces.
All right. Al is on the line next from Cedar Rapids at 866-780-9100. Hi, Al.
Hey, thank you.
What's your question?
Well, I had a tree and a stump removed from my front yard, and I've got a spot about 15 by 15, and yesterday I had sod laid down. And my question is, how often and what would be the best time of day to water that sod?
Let's see now. You dug out the stump, and then you put sod over the top?
Exactly.
Okay. Watering it once a day, I would assume you've got pretty good soil under there that you put back in where the stump was. Generally, once a day, it's going to need about an inch and a half total moisture during the week. And I would probably, on new sod, put that down in at least 3 applications over a 7-day period. You don't want to let it get dry because you can lose sod pretty quick. It should root down, though, in a week to 2 weeks where you can start cutting back on the amount of moisture.
Okay. And is there any better time of day to water than others?
Not really. You'll read things about disease development and stuff if you're watering at night. I would say if I had a choice, I'd go early morning if you can. A lot of times that depends on, you know, whether you're working and so on. But if you're around in the morning, I would give it a shot in the morning. And then if it's a hot day, 1 in the afternoon.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay. And Nick, how much watering does he need to do?
He needs to make sure that he's got enough water that it goes down through the sod and the underlying soil is wet. I'd like to see it wet down about 3 or 4 inches. A mistake that people make with new sod is to sprinkle it on top and it doesn't even get down into the underlying soil. You can lose that sod pretty quick. So you need to get it wet. You need to get the underlying soil wet through the sod.
All right. Al, thank you so much for your call. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Nick Christians, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University and Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. You can join the conversation by calling 866-780-9100. Amy's on the line next from Columbus Junction. Hi, Amy.
Hi. And I've got another weed question for you. I think I know what I can do to it, but I just want to know what it is. I live out in the country, and we had a section of lawn that we couldn't mow because of the wet, and now it's got this weed growing that's like 10 or 12 feet tall. It's got clusters of white flowers all over it, and the stem is like a cane. Would you know what that is? And I don't know if there's any organic way to get rid of it other than to pull it up by hand.
Boy, and this Richard, I don't recognize the description. And mowing now would be the best way to get rid of most of those kinds of plants. They can't take mowing, so you mow them a couple times and they're gone.
Is this a grass or?
Oh, it's tall. It's got branches on it. It's and it looks kind of like Queensland lace, but it's not that. It's just it's got several clusters of that of white flowers all over it. Someone said they called it horseweed at one point, but I don't see. Never seen any reference to something called horseweed.
Well, I don't think that's what it is, but the flower clusters are kind of flattish.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, and fairly large.
Yes.
Okay, it could be something in the wild carrot family. You have wild carrot and things like that. I think the best way to do it would be to cut it. Those plants in that family are biennials. They typically bloom the second year, so I would cut it and, if necessary, remove some of that debris, but I would just cut it somehow.
Okay. Just like, so, like, we whack it and then try to keep
it mowed after
instead.
That. Right, right.
Yeah, because it's obliterated all the grass. I mean, it's just that now.
Okay.
It's really weird. So, all right, well, thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Amy. Thanks a lot for your call. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Rick is up next in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Morning. Excuse me. I have a watering question. I was wondering, can I use my basement humidifier water for potted herbs and vegetables on our deck? And can we use it just for watering in general and any plants?
You should be able to. What you might want to do is maybe wash that collector with something to make sure it's nice and clean so it doesn't have anything on it. But then you should be able to use it to water plants, yes.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right, Rick. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Ruth in Loudoun. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I have Bohemian plum trees, at least that's what they're called, that... I gave dormant oil spray, and they have plums on, and they usually rot about the time they ripen. I have used sulfur for it. Is this too late to start that, or fruit tree spray? What do you suggest?
I'd probably use a fruit tree spray or a home orchard spray.
Okay.
And I would use that on a regular basis to follow directions on the container and do that thoroughly and on schedule. And I would think that would prevent that. Now, if they have a large number of fruit, you may want to do some thinning so they don't overdo themselves, and actually lead to some breakage of the branches. So, if they're very heavily loaded, I would do some thinning.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Ruth. And next up, let's go to Kim in Des Moines. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Yes. I was wondering if you could tell me why there's a red elm in Des Moines, Iowa, that's probably 80 years old that doesn't show signs of Dutch elm disease. It's right along the street on Southwest 9th, and I think it's probably, you know, planted by the city years ago. But come, you know, August, whatever, where generally they start showing stress of Dutch elm, this thing has never shown.
Well, right. Dutch elm disease wiped out most of the American elms in the 60s and 70s in Iowa. There were a few lucky trees that actually did survive. In fact, we have two on campus here at Iowa State. The disease is still around. It's still killing trees. There are a few trees that are truly tolerant or resistant, but I would say most are simply lucky. And the tree on campus here at Iowa State, at least one of them, is no longer lucky. It's starting to die. So we think it has Dutch elm disease. So it's still out there. And we think those trees that did survive, mainly it was just luck. They just didn't get it. Which is kind of sad for the tree on campus. It was huge, one of the landmark trees on campus, but it appears to be dying. So unfortunate.
Kim, thanks a lot for your call. And let's get to some email questions before we get to the break. Kathy would like to know when she can cut the tops off her iris plants.
As far as the actual flower head, they want to do that, deadhead those as soon as they're done blooming. So you want to do that promptly. As far as the foliage, leave that until basically late fall.
All right. And this one's from Mike. Ames just announced a program to improve lawn soil infiltration, including aeration, topping with compost, and seeding. This is to be done now. What is the likely success of this treatment compared to fall?
I don't think there'd be any difference between doing it now and the fall. That's going to be a long-term fix that you're going to have to be persistent with. That's going to take several years. It's not going to work any miracles. If you've got really bad drainage, it's not going to give you good drainage right away. It is a positive procedure, but it's going to take a long time.
All right, but it doesn't make any difference.
I can't think of it. Well, aerification at this time of year when the grass is under a lot of stress can add to the stress of grass. I would prefer when it's cooler in the fall, but would it hurt anything right now if they had to get to it now? I doubt it. As long as you watered it, it should be fine.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions on Horticulture Day. With me, Nick Christians, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, or you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Horticulture Day today, and you're welcome to join our conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100 or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, Nick Christians. And let's do another email question before we get back to the phones. This is from Josh in Iowa City. I have a 70-plus-year-old honey locust tree in my backyard, and I'd like to make some changes to grade around this tree. My current plan is to elevate the area around the honey locust 3 feet. How should I do this to minimize stress on the tree? Should I add a foot of dirt a year? Can I add 3 feet all at once? Does the tree need a tree well around the trunk? Or can I just slowly add dirt against the trunk?
We need a new plan, I'm afraid. That's just not going to work. The root system is very, very close to the surface. Most of your tree's roots are within the upper 8 to 12 inches. If you put it on maybe 4 or 5 inches, that could damage the root system. And basically what it does is it basically deprives some of the roots of oxygen, and they basically suffocate. So that's the reason for that. They're close to the surface because that's where the nutrients are, that's where the water is, but they also need to breathe. So if he needs to add 3 feet, I think he has to rethink his plan because it's just not going
to
work.
All right. So if he needs to add 3 feet, he might also have to remove the tree.
Correct.
And how long is that process? I've seen people put in rock gardens and things like that around their trees and really bury the root system. How long is the process before the tree actually dies?
Well, it may not be immediate. Oftentimes it isn't. Oftentimes, for example, when people buy a wooded lot and they build a house in that wooded lot and they change the grade, oftentimes they don't see anything for 2 or 3 years, and then they notice some dieback occurring. And then within maybe 4 to 5 years, those trees are dead. So oftentimes it doesn't happen immediately, and you think you're okay, and then 2 or 3 years later you start to see some dieback. So.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Doug is on the line from Davenport. Hi, Doug.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Good. I've Googled it before, and it appears that in one of my mulch beds, I've got this stuff that looks like dog vomit mold, I believe is what it's called.
Right.
And, I mean, the stuff actually moves. And, I mean, I've sprayed it with a hose before, and it just spews mold spores. And first question is, I mean, is this stuff dangerous? And my second question is, how do I get rid of it? Thank you.
Dog vomit fungus or mold. It's also called slime mold. It's kind of a yellow color, and it just kind of appears very suddenly, and then usually it dries up within a few days too. So it's not long term, but you see it growing on wood type mulches very commonly, especially in the summertime. I tend to ignore it, but you can go out with like a shovel and simply physically remove it if you want to. There's no way to prevent it in the future, except you might go out possibly with like a rake and simply loosen your wood mulch, and that will encourage it to dry out, and that would discourage maybe the slime mold in the future because it likes damp, moist conditions, and if you dry it out a little bit, it may kind of go away for a while.
Richard, let me add something to that. Nick Christians again. I've got a blog from Iowa State, the Iowa Turfgrass blog, and you can get that by Googling. And I did a post on slime mold a while back with a bunch of pictures. So you could get on there and then just search slime mold, and a story will come up on it.
All right, and we'll find that too and post that in the comments section on our Horticulture Day post today on our Facebook page. And let's get to, since we're on the subject of mold, lovely topic, let's do a Twitter question here. I have white mold on my peonies. Should I cut them back or leave it be?
As long as most of the foliage is green, I would leave it. You may have spotting, you may have mold, whatever, but I would tend to leave it so that the remaining healthy portion can go ahead and function and manufacture food for the plant. And then this fall, like in October, mid to late October, then I would cut the actual foliage back to the ground. I would carefully clean up all that debris, remove it from the garden, and destroy it.
All right. And she also had one more question about my lice. I may say this wrong. Lysimachia.
Okay.
Is browning from the bottom? What's wrong?
I'm not quite sure. It could be because we had very wet conditions. There might be some type of minor leaf disease there. But I guess I wouldn't worry about it a great deal. If it's real thick, possibly maybe doing some thinning so you have better air circulation might be of some benefit either this fall or early next spring.
All right. And let's get back to the phones now. Ciela is on the line from Fairfield. Hi, Ciela.
Hi.
Hi. What was your question?
My question is, I want to replace my entire lawn with a hardy, very low-growing ground cover that will winter well and that I can walk on, and so I never have to mow again. It's getting just too expensive.
Well, it sounds like grass to me, really, because most ground covers you can't really walk on. I mean, there are a number of ground covers you could plant, but you really can't walk on. That's one of the nice things about turf. You can walk on it, you can play on it, you can do various things on it.
But you have to mow it.
Yes, you do.
I don't want to mow anymore.
Well,
so that I could just not walk on it, but maybe put some stepping stones or something in places.
Well, you could maybe try something like buffalo grass, a possibility.
Okay.
Fescues might be a possibility, too. They'll get about 10 to 12 inches high, and then they'll lay over. But I don't know if you're going to be happy with the appearance. You can walk on that, but it's not easy. Yeah, you won't be able to achieve the quality that you have with the lawn without having a grass that you can mow.
I don't want to do that. Is there something that's more like that would work in this climate? That's more like a moss.
Well, mosses typically are kind of hard to maintain. And so I don't really think that is going to be a very good option. You do have a number of ground covers that you could grow, but you typically just can't walk on those. You simply can't do that.
So if I don't want to walk on it, are there any that winter well and are hardy enough and low enough so I don't have to mow?
Well, you could maybe try something like creeping lily turf.
Okay.
Which is a ground cover.
Okay.
It grows in sun or shade.
Okay.
It is a grass-like plant.
Okay.
It grows about, I would say, 8 to 12 inches tall.
Oh.
I have some in my yard. I use it in the shady areas.
Okay.
You can grow this basically in sun to part shade, and it does spread.
Okay.
And You can buy this at garden centers. That would be a possibility, I guess, if you wanted to go that route. I guess the other possibility that I can think of would be that you could plant maybe some of the native grasses and wildflowers.
Yes.
Okay. Now, most of your native plants are fairly tall.
Yes.
But there are some that are much shorter. And so you might want to find a mix where you have some of the native plants that are a little bit shorter in stature.
Okay.
And try to establish that. Now, if you do that, though, it does take quite a bit of labor involved initially to establish it.
Uh-huh.
So you have to put a lot of work into it maybe for a year or two to establish that. But
okay.
That would be another possibility where you maybe try some of these native prairie plants,
okay.
But some of the more shorter species.
Okay.
For example, big blue stem gets to be 4 to 6 feet tall. You don't want that.
Right.
But there are some other grasses that might work that are native in nature.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your help. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Sheila.
Thank
you. I guess she's had it with mowing. Let's go next to Rob in Ames. Hi, Rob.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
Okay. I'm looking for some advice on preparing a soil bed for blueberries. And I know that the soils here in Iowa are a little bit alkaline, and I'm wondering what the recommended soil prep is for lowering the pH and having enough organic material to successfully grow blueberries in Iowa.
How many plants are we talking about?
Oh, just a small, maybe 5 to 10.
Okay, easy enough. Okay, easy. I would just go to my local garden center and buy sphagnum peat moss. It's processed peat moss. It's in a bale. I'm sure you've seen it. The sphagnum peat moss is very, very acidic. And so what I would do is when you plant your blueberries, dig a very wide hole, maybe 3 feet wide, much wider than you really need, but a fairly shallow hole because blueberries have a shallow root system. And then I would take half of the soil from that hole and then mix that with an equal amount, volume-wise, of the sphagnum peat moss. So you have a 50-50 mix. And then backfill with that mix, and you should have the proper pH. You should be just fine. In the future, I would be inclined to go out maybe in the spring of the year, and I would fertilize with ammonium sulfate. And the ammonium supplies nitrogen for the plants, and the sulfur tends to acidify the soil. So you can maintain your acidity quite nicely with a little bit of sulfur periodically.
All right. Rob, thanks a lot for your call. And let's get to Jim now in Des Moines. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I've got a 7-year-old North Star cherry tree that's been doing very well. And I thought that this year was going to be maybe much more productive than it turned out to be as far as picking the actual cherries.
Hmm.
And it wasn't very productive, but it's got on a small percentage of the leaves a white mold kind of, and the leaves are like crispy. They're not everywhere, but there is a percentage of leaves that have that. What do you think?
I'm not sure offhand. Percentage-wise, maybe 5% of the foliage, 25%.
Well, less than that, less than 5.
Okay. I guess I wouldn't be greatly concerned. If the percentage started to go up quite a bit, then I'd probably have it identified.
Do you think part of the productivity problem, though?
Well,
it was just full of blossoms this spring. It was absolutely beautiful.
I don't think it is, and I'm not sure why they're not producing, because a lot of fruit trees are producing very, very well this spring, very well. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what the problem was. I don't think that's a major factor, and if it's just a small percentage, I don't think it's going to affect the health of the tree that much, so I wouldn't worry about it. But if you start to see a greater percentage of leaves affected, then I'd want to know exactly what it is. And so you may want to send a sample to the plant diagnostic clinic. But if it's a small percentage, I wouldn't worry about it.
I was just mostly curious if it had an effect on the productivity, if that was something that was affecting the rest of the tree, even though you couldn't visually see it.
I would think not. No, I really don't think it did. And this spring, we did not have a late frost or freeze. They are self-fruitful. So if they were full of flowers, then logically they should have quite a bit of fruit. I'm not sure what the problem was offhand.
I mean, birds certainly can't eat 95% of the fruit, can they?
No, and they typically wait until they ripen. They're not really interested when it's still green. They just ignore them. And the same with squirrels and coons and things like that. So, but as soon as they ripen, then they start to feed. So, no, I'm not sure exactly what happened there if they did not form.
All right, Jim. Sorry about that. I hope next year turns out better. Let's try to get in at least one more call. Helen is on the line from Ames. Hi, Helen.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I've got a mystery. I always buy these seed tapes. I usually buy them from Burpee. I buy the carrots and the beets because I absolutely love them. That way I don't have to worry about pinching the seeds in there. Well, I planted my beet seed tape and my carrot seed tape. They turned out wonderful. But I planted another crop of carrot seed tapes, and I went out to look to see if there's anything coming up, and there's nothing there. Even the white stuff, the white thing that the seeds are in is gone. Everything's gone. It's completely gone. There's nothing there.
Okay. I'm not sure.
Neither am I. I was amazed. I dug down and dug down, and the soil's nice and loose and wonderful, and there's nothing there, not even the paper.
Okay. I don't have a good explanation.
Neither do I.
If something had dug it up, I think you would have been able to see that.
Yes.
Where they had dug it up.
Yes.
I don't have a good explanation. Don't know. I would try again.
Well, I'm going to buy seed tapes. I absolutely love them. I did call Burpee and ask them if they knew what happened, and they were in a mystery, too. They have no idea what happened. Not even a piece of the paper the seeds came in. Is there nothing?
Wow, Helen. Yeah, well, if you figure it out, let us know.
That's I would try again.
All right, Helen, thanks a lot for your call. And one quick question from email. Cheryl says her lovely neighbor planted wisteria on her fence at the side of my yard. I have a raised vegetable garden 2 feet from the fence. I prune invading runners back to the stem on her side of the fence regularly. But what do I do about the roots invading the vegetable garden?
You really can't do much. They're going to do that. I suppose you could try going down the side of your yard with a spade and cutting down maybe 8 inches or 10 inches and trying to cut off the roots. You could try that, but otherwise you really can't do a great deal, I'm afraid.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. Nick Christians, thank you. Nick Christians is a professor of horticulture at Iowa State University, also a turfgrass specialist. We did put up a link to his blog on our Facebook page. You can find it in the comments section of the post that we made about horticulture today. We'll be back with Horticulture Day next Friday. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Garrett Van Leeuwen in Ames. And River to River host Ben Kiefer is here with me now. River to River on at noon. What's coming up today, Ben?
Hi, Charity. I have one question for you and listeners coming up at noon. Do you have a sound or a noise that helps you fall asleep or stay asleep? I've been asking people the last few days. That's a focus of our talk as we talk with Dr. Eric Dykin of the University of Iowa Sleep Disorders Center. The role of sound and noise in sleep. For good sleep, for bad sleep.
I was going to say, I can tell you a noise that doesn't help me sleep, and
that's
firecrackers, followed by dogs barking at firecrackers.
Could it be July 5th that we're having this conversation, and that maybe you had some disrupted sleep last
night,
Charity
and
Nebby?
Maybe the night before.
Okay, well, welcome all kinds of questions about good and bad sleep at noon with Dr. Eric Dykin.
All right, thanks a lot, Ben. I'm Charity Nebby. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.